You're listening to Beyond the Ribbon, a podcast of the Cancer Survivorship Center, powered by 24 Hours in the Canyon. This podcast is brought to you by Auto Inc. Auto Inc. is a distinguished family of dealerships redefining automotive excellence. Be sure to check out their website at autoinc.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Beyond the Ribbon. My name is Ryan Parnell, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host and oncology nurse, Pam McMillan.
Hey, Ryan. How are you today?
Pam, I'm doing great. You doing all right?
I'm doing okay. How many times do people walk into our building and we think you are a survivor? Do they look that part? How do we know that they're a survivor?
We have to ask. Yeah. You know, a lot of times that people come in like with a spouse, a loved one, a sister, a brother, whatever the case may be. And we go, all right, who's my survivor? Who are we talking mm-hmm. to?
You know, sometimes the patient looks good on the outside, but sometimes inside it's not always okay.
That's right. That's right. You know,
and with going through treatment, and they might be a long-term survivor, and they may have issues that we don't even know about.
That's right. That's right. Sometimes I feel like we play a good game of Clue or whodunit, right? Just to try mm-hmm. to say, what kind of needs do you have? How can we help right. you? Sometimes that's a challenge, isn't it?
Yes. And, you know, even after treatment and years down the road, they still need support.
Yes.
And, absolutely. You know, lucky for us, we're here.
That's right.
And, we need to know more about long-term survivorship. What can we do better for those patients?
Yeah, that's a very good point. You know, one of the beautiful things I think about our center is there's no cap, right? So we don't say, well, you have reached X number of years of post-cancer. Congratulations. See you later. We're moving on to someone else. I mean, it's open-ended. We're here as long as you need us. And that's a very unique thing. And I think too, right, Pam, we've got a great guest today, don't we?
Yes, we do. You know, hopefully we can get some insight to, long-term survivorship. I can remember a story when we very first opened our door. We had a survivor come in that was 20 years out, and she said, well, I need your service. And I remember calling you thinking, why does she need our services? Like, she's good, right?
Yeah.
We need to stop and, take a look maybe on the inside and don't take the book by its cover, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I remember that day very well. And, mm-hmm. We were both new into this survivorship world and trying to navigate that. And as I've often said, unfortunately, there's no manual on how to set up and design and operate and do survivorship. So we have adapted over time, and we welcomed that person in, that 20-year survivor in, like we welcome a brand new diagnosed folk today. So yeah, it's been a long journey and fun, but I tell you, I'm really excited to speak with our guest today. So let me tell you guys listening about today's episode. Scott Capoza has worked as a physical therapist in a multidisciplinary survivorship clinic, as well as an outpatient physical therapist dedicated to oncology rehab. He received a master's of physical therapy degree from Ithaca College in 1999. He initially worked in a pediatric physical therapy world, but then decided, I really want to make the transition to adult oncology rehab. And I think we're all going to be glad that he did. Scott is actually among the first class of board certified clinical specialists in oncologic physical therapy in the U.S., which is really awesome. He also does a lot of writing for the oncology certification exam through the American Board of Physical Therapy Specialists, and holds several leadership positions within the American Physical Therapy Association, including the APTA Media Corps and the Academy of Oncology Physical Therapy. Scott, thank you, sir, for joining us and taking time out of your day to visit with us on our podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a great honor, and I'm happy we're connecting.
Absolutely. You know, long-term survivorship, that's a label, right? And we talk about labels often here. Like some people say, I don't feel like a cancer survivor, but we say you are because that's the label and that's the buzz. But what are we talking about when we talk about long-term survivorship?
Well, I mean, I'm sure you probably have talked about this too, you know, in previous episodes and with your own patients, is that, you know, we like to go by the, you know, the American Cancer Society and the NCI definition that you're a cancer survivor from the moment of diagnosis. And the way that I always explain it to my patients, especially if I'm seeing them, you know, in the middle of active treatment, if I'm seeing them as an outpatient physical therapist, is that I always tell them that you had to survive the words, you have cancer.
Yeah.
So you're a survivor from that moment on. When we talk about long-term survivorship, it's really about making sure that we are screening and staying on top of some of those late effects that we see because of treatment. So, you know, we're talking about cardiac issues that may not necessarily show up, you know, a year or two after treatment, but maybe shows up later on in life. Or we're talking about pulmonary issues from chemotherapy, potential secondary cancers caused by the very treatment that got them through their first cancer diagnosis. So those are some of the things that we're thinking about in long-term survivorship. And my role specifically in our multidisciplinary survivorship clinic is really, it's almost like a lifestyle modification, lifestyle medicine approach, where we want people to make those long-term, to make those changes so that it helps prevent the risk of recurrence throughout the balance of their life. And for me specifically, you know, I'm really cued in to the adolescent and young adult population, you know, those that are diagnosed with cancer in their 20s or 30s, because potentially they're going to have decades of life ahead of them, which is fantastic. But that just means that they've got a longer runway to run into all of these late effects that are going to hit them. And I'm just talking about the physical ones. We're not even talking about the psychosocial side effects, the financial side effects, you know, the long-term down the road financial toxicity that patients run into. And what is that? How does that affect the return to work? So there's a lot that goes into long-term survivorship. So it's not just that first year post-active treatment. We're really thinking about 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road.
Scott, can you back up just a little bit and talk about your personal story and how you became a long-term survivor?
I was diagnosed with stage 2 testicular cancer when I was in my last year of physical therapy school, way back in 1998. You know, I tell everybody that I don't feel that I fit the type, so to speak, in that I was a collegiate athlete. I ran cross country and track, and so I was always in pretty good shape. I did not drink, and I did not smoke, and I did not do drugs. There was also no family history of cancer. Mm-hmm. So I never thought that I'd be the one that would get cancer. So in my last year of grad school, I had to deal with the cancer diagnosis and finishing my academics and also trying to figure out life as a 22, 23-year-old, you know. I still want to go out to the bars with my friends, you know. It'd be nice if I went out on a date, you know, all the things that, you know, the 20-somethings were supposed to be doing. So, you know, so a lot of that, you know, I had to, balance all of that. And so that was, at this point now, at the point that we're recording this podcast, that was 27 years ago now.
Yeah. Wow. You know, you said something, Scott, and Pam, I know we have heard it. What Scott just said was like, I did everything right. Like, I'm healthy, I'm fit, I'm eating right. Scott was a runner. I don't drink, I don't smoke, why me? And I think that's, you know, that's the million-dollar question, right? But I know that we have heard that so many times that, I mean, you didn't do anything to cause this. It's just the proverbial unlucky lottery in this case, especially with you, with being no one in your family, the first in your family to have cancer.
Mm-hmm. And the way that it was explained to me, I was very lucky at one point that I was able to go to the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, to be part of a clinical trial or a clinical study. You know, one of the doctors there explained it to me that you know, just if we're thinking about our genes, you know, everybody is born with some level of risk, and so it really is a matter of, you know, our genes do play a large role on that. And so what were you born with? You know, like he used the analogy of your water bottle. You know, if your water bottle is only just a little bit full, you start off with low risk. You know, you can be exposed to some environmental toxins, and maybe you can, you know, experiment with smoking when you're in college or whatever. You drink a little bit too much when you're in college or whatever, but it's never enough to make the cup or to make your water bottle overflow, so you never get cancer. But maybe other people, they're born with a higher risk, like their water bottle is already 3/4, 7/8 full, mm-hmm. And so it doesn't take much, you know, to be exposed to something in the environment, or, you know, not the best diet or whatever, to make your cup overflow, to make your water bottle overflow, and then you get cancer. So, you know, I do think that that's going to be a big part of, you know, where medicine goes over the next several years, like to really hone in on the genes and figure out, you know, who's at low risk, who's at high risk, and, you know, can we move survivorship even further upstream to say, like, can we prevent it by recognizing it, you know, in everybody's genetic code?
So you're 27 years out from treatment. What kind of side effects do you still experience from your treatments?
So I experience fertility issues. So I'm essentially infertile because of both the surgeries and the chemotherapy that I had. So again, that is a, you know, if you're somebody who's diagnosed in their 50s or 60s, that's not necessarily as much of an issue. However, diagnosed as a 22-year-old who did not have a family, that was a major issue. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of my first real big, you know, survivorship concerns that I had to grapple with, was paying for cryopreservation, which some of it's covered by insurance and some of it's not. And then the emotional aspect of, you know, when I return to dating, how do you bring that up? Do you bring that up on a first date? Do you not bring that up on a first date? You know, Ryan, you said that perfectly. There's no blueprint for any of this. So there's no blueprint to say, you know, how do you disclose your cancer diagnosis when you're trying to date?
Yeah.
Right. So that was probably my first thing, was the fertility issues early on. And then later on, my exercise capacity decreased, which I attribute to the bleomycin chemotherapy that I had. And so I, as I alluded to, I was a runner. I was a competitive runner. And then about 10 years post-treatment, it really started to settle in. And I kind of lost that ability, you know, to run competitively. And now it's really hard for me to run. So I don't run anymore. That's why I switched to cycling, because it doesn't tax my cardiovascular system as much. You know, I can rest when I'm on the bike versus, you know, when I'm running. So, and now again, as a 27-year survivor, but also now the father of two boys, my survivorship concerns are not a recurrence in me, but they're my boys.
Yeah.
They mm-hmm. have my genes.
Yep.
So I'm not worried about a recurrence in me. I'm worried about an occurrence in them.
Right. And that's one of those things I think that, you know, obviously no one thinks about until that happens, right? And so, again, it's the weird, the crazy side effects and the crazy things that happen continually now, 27 years, now that you've got boys, it continues to compound and continues to add stresses and worries. And how do you deal with that?
I do exercise as my stress reliever. You know, so I will get on the bike and I will blow off some steam that way. I'm very lucky that I have a very, I have a great team. The survivorship team that I work with is great, and we have become, you know, not just colleagues but friends. And so and I obviously know my history, so you know, it's very easy for me to be able to share some of this with them. I trust them, but I think, you know, Ryan and Pam, you know, to kind of get to the root of our conversation for today, you know, this whole idea of, and this is what I tell my own survivors too that I see in my clinic, is survivorship is fluid. Survivorship is not linear, which is also an interesting thing for me as a physical therapist, because, you know, Ryan, if you had a knee replacement, you know, you'd go to PT, and that's, there's an expected linear progression in your recovery, right? You're going to get a certain amount of mobility in your knee 6 weeks after surgery. You're going to get a certain amount of mobility back in your knee, you know, 3 months, right? And it's a linear progression. That's not survivorship. Mm-hmm. Survivorship is fluid. It changes over time. Again, think of me. When I was diagnosed, I was young. I was single. You know, I had not even started my career yet. And I also did not want to, even if oncology rehab was a thing when I graduated, I was not in the headspace to do that. And now my survivorship needs are different because I'm married and I have children and I also work in this space. So my needs have changed over time. And I think that that's what we see with our long-term survivors, is that their needs, they have unique needs as well. And their needs at 15 years, 20 years are going to be different than what they were 1 year out. 1 year out, they're still in that recovery phase. I still think that somebody who's a year out is still trying to, you know, recover with fatigue, you know, potentially chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, you know, those types of things. 15 years out, it's different.
Mm-hmm. So you wrote this article, Patient is Otherwise Healthy. Can you tell our listeners what brought that article about?
I will say that I'm very fortunate that I have a primary care physician who listens to me. And plus, every time I go into the office, he always does an EKG as part of my physical. And it's just my anatomy that it throws off inverted T waves, and it like throws the nurses into a tizzy. I'm like, no, that's just who I am. But I was telling him about this, you know, this decreased exercise intolerance. And, you know, I'm thankful that he took me seriously, because he looked at my history. And, and he's not an expert. I mean, he's a generalist primary care physician. He's not an onco primary care physician. So oncology is not his forte, but he looked at my chart. He knew I had chemo. He listened to me. And he said, well, let's just make sure we're not missing anything. I'm going to send you for a cardiac workup, and I'm going to send you for a pulmonary workup. You know, and so thankfully everything was fine on the cardiac side, but it was the pulmonary side where I flunked my pulmonary function test. You know, and so the pulmonologist couldn't believe that here's this otherwise healthy looking guy, you know, sitting in front of him. I don't look like a cancer patient because my hair's grown back and, you know, I don't have a port and all the things. But again, it was the note of my primary care physician when he said, you know, patient is an otherwise healthy 42, 43 year old, however old I was at the time. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not really otherwise healthy. Like if I was otherwise healthy, you wouldn't have sent me for a cardiac workup, you know, mm-hmm. and a pulmonary workup. I wouldn't be wearing hearing aids because of the ototoxicity from the cisplatin that I had. You know, I have, you know, high cholesterol, which maybe that's familial. Maybe that's also from my treatments. So, you know, I don't consider myself otherwise healthy. So, I mean, part of it was to think about the language as professionals that we use. I wrote it. And Dr. Miriam Lusberg, who's the director of the the press center here at Smilo, she encouraged me to get it published. And so so I sent it to JCO Oncology Practice and they published it. But yeah, I think it was I wanted providers to know, you know, Pam, as you were alluding to, like, just because we don't look sick on the outside doesn't mean there aren't things going on. Our bodies have deteriorated. Our bodies deteriorate faster than the non-cancer population. You have to be able to screen for these late effects throughout the balance of our lives.
Mm-hmm. You wrote, I wish our listeners could see my copy of your published article, and I've highlighted several things, and many of those you've already touched on, but there's one thing that I think I want to touch on, because, and I just want to read it because it's worded so perfectly. And we've kind of hinted around this, and you wrote, while we may be living clinically with no evidence of disease, we live with the evidence of the history of our disease every day. And that really struck a nerve with me, like, ooh, like this is why, Pam, you do your treatment summaries and care plans for folks, because all throughout this published article, Scott, you're referring to, like, I'm telling the pulmonologist, oh, but remember, I had cancer and I had this kind of chemo. Remember this, I had this. I'm this guy. This is who I am. And so to be educated to the point to where you can speak intelligently about what you had and be able to communicate that to physicians, because they're busy, right? Physicians are busy. Physicians see 20 Scots in a day. You know, they're not going to catch everything. We want them to be perfect, but we know they're not. And so I just love that statement. And I think it validates the necessity to be educated about your treatment.
Right. And I think, you know, and Ryan, what you're hitting on there, I think, again, is, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see. And I know that, you know, that some, you know, like Samantha Siegel, for example, who's out in California, who herself is a young adult cancer survivor also, like, she's trying to start an onco primary care residency. So, you know, individuals who go into primary care, but they also have that interest in oncology, get that extra training, that extra layer. And again, you know, like, we can't know every single drug and every single immunotherapy, right? It seems like every day there's a new immunotherapy which comes out, which is great. You know, more tools in the toolbox for the oncologist to use, but it's so hard to stay on top of all that. But at least to give them that foundational knowledge, so again, that they can ask those questions. But Ryan, also, I will say that sometimes, you know, and I'm obviously a healthcare provider, so I know the questions to ask, because I also tell my own patients that they need to ask those questions. And I have a medical degree. I have a medical background. And it's tiring for me to have to continue to advocate for myself and remind the doctors, right? So what about our patients who don't have a medical background, who don't have the same medical training, the health literacy that the three of us have, right? Those are the survivors that we really have to empower. And Pam, to your point, like, give them the survivorship care plan, give them the words and the tools, so, and the ability for them to go advocate for themselves. And sometimes we have to advocate alongside them. I mean, literally before we logged on, I was sending a note to somebody that we saw in clinic today to say, we saw somebody in clinic today with a history of thyroid cancer. She's reporting difficulty with swallowing. Can you please put in a referral for speech and language and for a swallow evaluation, right? Because she didn't know that she could do that. Yeah. The patient didn't know that she should even ask that question.
Right.
So that becomes our responsibility. That should be our responsibility as providers. It should not always 100% fall on the patient to have to do that.
Yeah. You know, I always tell the patients that I see is, it's okay to ask your physician, questioning them, or if you need more information, ask their nurses. That's what they're there for.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I do. I worry about some of our folks just for that very reason that, and I know, Pam, you've heard it. They saved my life. I don't want to bother them. They're busy. Whatever excuse or, you know, you put in there, it is very important to ask the questions. And you're right, too. I know, Pam, you've been a sounding board here for and a resource for folks to say, no, you just need to call your doctor, you know, right, when they come to you. And like, so, you know, I get what you're saying, Scott. It is very, very, very important to empower them. And then also, as medical providers or medical in the having the knowledge, it's important to share that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So, Scott, for our listeners that are long-term survivors, as far as physical therapy, what advice would you give them?
I would say, because I see this off, I see this more, maybe more so in my outpatient oncology practice. Sometimes people will be going along, and then all of a sudden they get that random ache or pain, mm-hmm. and because we work in this space, we know that so many of their heads are going to go to, oh my gosh, has the cancer come back? And so maybe they go and they get some imaging, and maybe they go and they talk to their doctor. But as a physical therapist, you know, we can make that differential diagnosis too. Or we might be working with them for something else, and then they tell us, you know, on the side, I have this random ache or pain in my ribs, and we know that, you know, they had, you know, chest wall radiation for breast cancer 10 years ago. Okay. Well, I can palpate that area and I can try to do my differential diagnosis. And if I feel that it's something that warrants imaging or, you know, it needs the doctor's attention, then I'm going to run that up to the doctor. And I'm going to say, hey, I saw Mrs. Smith today. This is what she reported to me. Like, let's get her in for some imaging because, you know, maybe she's got this idiopathic rib fracture as a result of her radiation that she had years ago. So, that's one of the many things that, you know, an oncology trained physical therapist can screen for is, you know, again, these late effects, but also again, to make sure that we're keeping our survivors healthy throughout the balance of their lives. And sometimes they just need a tune up. I mean, I can't tell you the number of folks that I work with who, you know, they were trying to exercise and then they got the flu, or, you know, they went on a vacation or they broke their ankle randomly and they got thrown off their routine, and then they feel a little bit weaker. They feel like their balance isn't great. Let's get you back into physical therapy and let's get you back into that routine. Because again, I want you exercising. We have the evidence now that shows that exercise improves survival rates, right? We've all saw the challenge trial that mm-hmm. was published this past summer in New England Journal of Medicine. I mean, the fact that we now can definitively prove that exercise improves survival rate, it helps decrease the risk of death. And when you put exercise up against oxaliplatin, it's better.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
It is. It is. And I think,
you know, and the great thing for our listeners is, you know, they have a facility that they can come exercise, and oh, it's free. So if you're in the surrounding area looking for a place to exercise, make sure you check us out.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, when you're looking at being told you need to exercise, and say to someone, hey, you know, it's recommended that you get 150 minutes, you know, here, you do this, you know, that's one thing, right? The other thing is guidance and learning and being shown. And so I know that what we do here at our center is our gym manager meets one-on-one with folks when they come into our gym for the first time, make sure they understand every little piece and part of what we have and what we do, and then also provides assistance anytime that she's there when they come into the gym to exercise. And so I think one of the things that I see our folks, and I'll get your opinion too, Scott, I know they're coming to you at your place of physical therapy, but so many don't even know where to begin, don't even know what to do. And so having that teach that teacher, that trainer, that whoever that is, physical therapist, show them that's an incremental better for them.
Yeah, and you both just hit upon, you know, such important points there, is that it's, you know, it's one thing to, yes, to talk about the guidelines, but we have to be able to take those national guidelines and distill them down and make them applicable to the person who's sitting in front of us. I can't tell everybody, you know, and any of us, we can't just tell them go exercise for 150 minutes and go strength training twice a week. If they don't have an exercise history, they don't know what that means. And even if they did have an exercise history, maybe they were going to the gym before, their body is in a different place. It is not the same body that they were in before. They are now in a post-cancer body, and they don't trust their body. And so that's when it's so important that, great, so you have somebody who's taking them through the pieces of equipment there and showing them how to do that. And I am, when I'm meeting with somebody, like, I'm talking to them about, how do you actually start a walking program? Right? 150 minutes is a big number if you're not doing any exercise and you're still tired from chemotherapy and radiation therapy. So you know what? We're going to start with 10 minutes three times a week.
Yeah.
Right? Can you, you know, I always love, you know, when people say, I got a dog, great. have the dog take you for a walk.
Yeah.
You know, for 10 minutes in the morning. But then, you know, if you can take the dog for a second walk, you know, midday, great. That's another 10-minute walk. And then if you can take the dog for one more 10-minute walk, you know, after dinner, I wasn't a math major, but that adds up to 30 minutes. And then you're on your way.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't happen overnight. Slow and gradual.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And we always talk about too, right, Pam, something is better than nothing. And, you know, especially those that come in deconditioned. And one of my favorite things that someone says is, I used to be able to, or I was doing this, but now here I am. And like, well, our goal is to get you back to that, you know, but you have to start slow and small and incremental and build it up. It's funny, Pam, Scott's speaking our language. It's like he's heard the things we've shared.
Yes.
Well, I think we all share the same brain here when it comes to, you know, we all want the same thing for our survivors, and we all understand just how critical, you know, this multidisciplinary approach to cancer survivorship is. And that's the other thing that that's why I'm grateful that I work in this clinic, is because I can't do this all by myself. Pam, I'm sure you can't do it all by yourself. So, like, we really need a team. You know, this is a team approach, you know, to have our rehab specialists, our dietitians, our social workers, you know, smoking cessation team, like, all of that. Like, that is all part of survivorship care, because we can't just do it by ourselves, because it's, you know, it's too big.
Right.
That's for sure.
So do you have anything else that you would like to share with our listeners before we get to our last segment that we haven't covered?
I would say, I mean, shameless plug, as far as, you know, if you are a cancer survivor, and whether you are, you know, in the facility, you know, of your facility, then that's fantastic. You know, if you're listening outside of the panhandle and you want to connect with a physical therapist, there's a great website called choosept.com where you can put your zip code in, and it'll help you find a physical therapist. If you're specifically looking for somebody who has a specialty in oncology, you can put that in there. So whether your listeners are in Texas or they're in Connecticut or wherever they might be, that they can connect with somebody.
Yeah. It's very vital, right, Pam? We talk about finding experts, and it's important to find the expert to help you out, whether that is in your state elsewhere or in Connecticut here, just as you said, you know. And also, I don't know, Scott, you'll know this, I think. A referral is still required to go to physical therapy, correct?
That's an excellent question. It actually depends on the state, because most states actually allow what's called direct access, where you can actually go, probably more so for somebody who has like a smaller private practice. Maybe if you were to do physical therapy at a major academic hospital, you might need the referral ahead of time. But a lot of times the smaller clinics, the privately owned physical therapy clinics, you can just walk right in and say, I want to have a physical therapy eval. And then they can get the referral later on, but they can get you in the door and they can get you started. And so, you know, rather than wait, like they can get you going right away.
Right.
Good. That's good.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story and enlightening our listeners. That brings us to our last segment, which is our Auto Inc. Inspiring Moment. Do you have an Auto Inc. Inspiring Moment that you could share with our listeners?
Oh, it's hard to pick just one. Years ago, I was working with a young boy who was he was diagnosed with a brain tumor when he was 3 years old. And I at that point I was working at an outpatient clinic as a pediatrics physical therapist, but he was on my schedule, and I started working with him, which was probably one of the first opportunities that I had to actually work with a cancer survivor, and especially somebody that young. So working with him really kind of piqued my interest, and is like, oh, well, we can actually do something. You know, I was trying to help him, you know, with just as a three-year-old, like the basic skills of movement and getting up and down stairs and not losing his balance and being able to be a three-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. And then our paths diverged for several years, and then our paths came back together. I was working at a facility, probably somewhat similar to your facility, that was a training facility for cancer survivors. And, you know, his balance was still a little off because his tumor was in his cerebellum, but he said, you know, his goal was to ride a bike. And I said, okay. And so we worked on it, and we worked on that for months. And I had to really start from the basic balance reactions with him. You know, and, you know, we had some good sessions, and I had some sessions when maybe I pushed him a little too hard and he swore at me, and that's okay. He was, at that point, he was a 13-year-old boy, so I fully deserved it. I didn't expect, should have expected it. You know, so we were able to work all through the fall and all through the winter and all through the spring. And then when the weather got nice, we were actually able to get outside and actually, like, I got him on a bicycle, and I would run next to him as he's trying to gain his balance on the bike. And he got to the point where he got it, and he became the honorary chairperson for our cancer center's annual bike ride.
Yeah.
And I was volunteering as a marshal, so I rode with him, through the streets of New Haven, Connecticut. So that was a very cool thing to be able to have worked with him when he was little, when he was first diagnosed as a three-year-old, and then as a 13, 14-year-old, you know, something as like mundane as riding a bike, like that was very challenging for him, but he was so determined. And he's still doing great. He just graduated college. And so,
awesome.
You know, yeah, he's doing great.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
Years after his treatment, you still were able to help him. So the message I'm gathering is, you know, physical therapy, it's never too late.
No, but it also goes back to, you know, again, the reason why we started this conversation in the first place. His survivorship needs changed.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, you talk about somebody who, I mean, he's been a survivor for pretty much his entire life. And he's had different challenges at different points throughout his life. You know, I can't even imagine, like, you know, he goes through a growth spurt in his teens, like that throws his balance off, right? And so, you know, again, like, you know, being in high school, what is that like as a childhood cancer survivor? Like, so those needs change over time. And so I think that's probably my take home message is that, yes, cancer survivor needs change over time. And so that's why cancer survivors need some sort of touch point with cancer survivorship care for the balance of their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that you could sum it up any better, Pam.
I don't think so. I think he did a very good job.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for sharing your knowledge.
Yeah, Scott.
Thank you very much for having me. This was a fun conversation.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us and for what you do there in Connecticut and advocating for cancer survivors and the Onco PT program. And I know that's exciting for you to be a part of that. And I know our listeners, Pam, I guarantee you there's quite a bit of imparted knowledge today that can take to heart. And so, gosh, again, thank you, Scott, for joining us. Pam, this has been great. I love speaking to folks and just, you know, as we always say, it's been a great day for learning.
That's right. It is.
That's right. Well, listen, if you guys are listening, if you need assistance, you need support, you need to be active, whatever that looks like your needs are at that moment. We just talked about it being fluid, but at this moment, we probably have the resource for you. If you live in the Texas Panhandle, we have the resource for you. You just need to reach out to us. You need to let us know. You need to advocate for yourself and be a part of our program. And it's very simple, right, Pam?
It's super simple. You can stop by our office at 1732 Hagee Boulevard. You can check us out on our website at 24survivorship.org or give us a call at 806-331-2400.
Yeah. Real simple, real easy. And again, take this podcast and share it. Share it with someone you know who is a cancer survivor going through cancer treatment or finished with treatment, because we too believe from the moment of diagnosis, you are a cancer survivor. And make sure they understand how important it is to take care of yourself long-term and be engaged in your healthcare. Pam, it's been great. I love doing this. And I think that's good enough homework, right?
I think so.
Do too. Well, thank you guys again for listening and joining us. Make sure you join us next time for another great episode of Beyond the Ribbon.
Thanks again for listening to Beyond the Ribbon. We'd like to extend a special thanks to the Auto Inc. family of dealerships, as they have supported the 24 Hours in the Canyon Cancer Survivorship Center since 2016. For more information on the Cancer Survivorship Center, please visit our website at 24survivorship.org.